You are listening to the sermon podcast of Connection Church, a gospel-centered community on a mission to make much of Jesus in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. For more information, visit siouxfallsconnection.com. Thank you for listening.
We are nearing the end of a year and also the end of a decade. We have a mathematician in our gospel community that I'm a part of, and she said, that's only exciting because we have base 10 number systems. So if you want to have the fun sucked out of the end of the decade, find your local mathematician and have them explain to you how pointless that is. But as we get to the end of a year and the end of a decade, we tend to reflect on what has been, what have been the themes. You've probably seen that a lot in the various social medias and different things in the news, like what have been the themes of this last decade and what can we look forward to in 2020? What can we be excited about? And we do things like New Year's resolutions. And although I'm not super excited about that and not intending to preach fully on that, we are going to talk a bit about that in terms of the things that we can do, the things that we do. And because of who we are, what we believe, how that leads to what we do in response, what are the eternal things that we can participate in? What are the eternal things that we can do? And how is that even possible? And the impossible nature of those things apart from the Messiah, which we've just celebrated the coming of in Christmas. And so in order to do that, we're going to look at Colossians 1, verses 15 through 23 today. So we'll be in Colossians chapter 1 today, verses 15 through 23. When I say that we're going to look at things that we can participate in, things that we can do that have eternal significance, especially in reflection on the last decade, the coming year, the new year, maybe even New Year's resolutions, what are the things that we can resolve to do? What are the things that we can dedicate ourselves to be doing? What I realize is that I'm only going to give you a piece of that at the very, very, very end. And it's not even what we're going to read about today. I'm going to point you to read about this next when you go home, but what we're going to read about today is the thing that God has done for us and how that leads to what we can do. And that is absolutely foundational for us as a church. That is the gospel, hence gospel community mission, which hopefully you've been exposed to in the life of this church, that the gospel comes first and that it informs who we are, how we relate to each other, which is the community, and then what we do, which is the mission. And so what we get to do, what we get to become as a people is a direct result of what God has done through Jesus, and that's what we're going to tackle today. And it's my hope, because we say on a regular basis that the gospel, if it is assumed, it's probably absent. That is, if we assume that the gospel, we don't say it, but we just say, I'm a Christian, my dad's a pastor, my family grew up in church. If we just say that, then we can assume that we mean, well, everything's good, the Bible, but we're going to actually talk about the gospel, and we're going to overuse the term the gospel, and because the gospel can even become a Christianese term, we're going to over-explain the gospel, and it's my hope that that becomes something we do on a regular basis. So Colossians is a letter from Paul, along with Timothy, but Paul mainly writes it to the people in Colossae, and it is 4 chapters long. We just break it into chapters, but it's a letter. You don't write letters in chapters. Probably Paul didn't either. But how it flows when you read it, and it's really short, so you'll get to go home and read the rest of it, which I strongly encourage you to do, since we're going to read just mostly chapter 1. It flows in verse 1, chapter 1 and chapter 2. It talks about the things, who God is, who Christ is, and what he has done for us. And then chapters 3 and 4 says, you know, because of this, now go and do this. And that is the flow, that is the direction of who we are as a people who have been redeemed by God. The imperatives in chapters 3 and 4, that is the do this, the imperatives, follow the indicatives of chapters 1 and 2. So that's what we're going to look at today. Chapter 1, we'll start in verse 15 and read all the way through verse 23. So he's given an introduction and he's begun to speak of Jesus, who is the Savior, the Messiah, and then he declares this about him. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, and in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. And you once were alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds, he has now reconciled in his body of flesh by his death, in order to present you holy and blameless and above reproach before him, if indeed you continue in the faith, stable and steadfast, not shifting from the hope of the gospel that you heard, which has been proclaimed in all creation under heaven, and of which I, Paul, became a minister. Now, to boil it down to what I hope to look at today, there are going to be many parts to this, but to boil it down, we're going to say that Colossians in this section tells us that Jesus restored our created purpose and identity as image bearers. And again, there's a lot of, if I had written this out as a thesis statement with all the parts that I wanted, it would be 5 pages long, the same length as my whole sermon. This is us boiling it down. There are many parts to this, but Jesus restored our created purpose and identity as image bearers. Now, to get us launched into thinking of this term, he is the image of the invisible God, what I'll bring you into understanding how we relate in the same way as image bearers. Jesus restored our created purpose as image bearers. I want to give you a picture of, we're going to turn the word image into a verb where we image things. And to paint that in the best picture that I know how to, all illustrations are imperfect, all analogies are imperfect. I want to give you what hopefully will be a good idea of what this looks like. And so this is my attempt at an illustration. And so here are a bunch of bananas. I just closed my means to change the slides. A bunch of bananas, and you're looking at them now as they exist in a three-dimensional atmosphere, in a three-dimensional plane. And you know this because if I move my hands around it, you can see that I can cover it up, but then it can also, my hand can be behind it. And the light changes around it, so the shadows can shift depending on where the light is. And if I took one and I broke it open, you would smell the smell of a banana and maybe even be tempted to eat the banana. And you can see the texture and the color on it. And so if I was to take this bunch of bananas and try to bring that into a two-dimensional field, a two-dimensional environment. This is what I do on a regular basis. I'm a graphic designer. I went to school for art and design, and there was a pivotal point in my education where I had to think through something in order to be able to design things and create things on a two-dimensional level. I was trying to create things that are in the three-dimensional world, a picture of them, design them in a two-dimensional way. And how do you do that realistically? And if some of you are handy with drawing or anything, painting, anything like that, you can understand this is a challenging thing, because you're taking something that is three-dimensional. I can turn it, you can experience it in so many different ways in different lights, but when you put it into a two-dimensional field, it is stationary and it's limited in how it can be portrayed. And so I just had to look at it, and I even put like hands at an I looked at an object, and I put my hands on either side of my eyes, kind of like horse blinders to limit my field of vision, and I looked at it as though it were stationary and not moving, not three-dimensional, and I tried to just imagine it like a photograph. So this is what this bunch of, probably standing in the way here, but this is what a bunch of bananas looks like in a photograph. And when we look at it, we can see that they're three-dimensional, real-life bananas, but they're portrayed in a two-dimensional field, in a two-dimensional environment. So you can't break it open and smell it. And so if you imagine that photograph is not moving, then you could even take a photograph either with your mind or with a camera, and you could maybe trace it and turn it into a drawing. And so you can, with a pen or charcoal, sketch over this image of a banana and sort of recreate it, re-image it, that maybe you can even add some color to it so that it even looks more and more like a banana. And so you might say that this drawing of a bunch of bananas images what these bananas are, points to, makes you think of a bunch of bananas, even though they're not in a three-dimensional environment. If these bananas are in a three-dimensional environment, it causes you to think of them. It bears witness to something that is real. And although you can break open these bananas and smell the aroma of bananas, you can't do that with a two-dimensional environment. So there are some aspects and characteristics of these bananas in the three-dimensional environment that cannot be communicated in a two-dimensional environment. In the same way, when God designed us, He said He created us in His image, and He gave us some attributes, like this picture of the bananas that looks like, you know, this yellow, it's got this crescent shape, but you can't break it open and smell it. So there are some characteristics and attributes that transfer. And in the same way, we as people made in God's image are made to image Him, but are not given all the qualities of God. So let's look back at this first in Genesis chapter 1, where we see this actually happen. It says, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.' And so God created man in His own image. In the image of God, He created him. Male and female, He created them." And so we see that God made us to bear His image. We are part of our created purpose and identity is to bear God's image. But Genesis chapter 3 continues on in the story. This is the serpent, that is the devil, was in the garden to mislead the woman. He said to the woman, "Did God actually say, 'You shall not eat of any tree in the garden?'" And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said, 'You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die.' But the serpent said to the woman, 'You will not surely die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.'" And so because God created us in His image to bear His image, the thing that we are to do, part of our identity and purpose, is to image him. The way that the fall happened, in the sort of the crux of the fall and the devil tempting mankind, was to say, but God is not actually, you could be like God. He created us, God did. We did not create ourselves, God created us. We were created by God with the very purpose of bearing God's image, of looking like him, such that we point to him in everything we love, say, and do. But when we rebelled, our rebellion was founded on the idea that we could be like God. Think three-dimensional world. Again, don't think too much. That analogy will fall apart eventually. But think three-dimensional world versus a two-dimensional atmosphere. Because image-bearing is still in the thrust of our created purpose, we need God in order to fulfill our purpose and identity. But in putting ourselves in the place of God to act as our own gods, we've removed the very thing that made our created purpose and identity possible. Instead of pointing to God, our Creator, we are left to image ourselves or, at best, something God created. Think self-confidence or self-expression. We cannot sustain this because we did not create us. Where do you see this in the world around you? Where's the brokenness as a result of this that you see? That's not good. Where do you see this in the world around you, the brokenness? I'm going to set this here just so that it doesn't get trampled on. The brokenness as a result of this identity crisis that comes from trying to image something, that being part of our created purpose and identity, but having removed the thing that we are to image from the throne. Think hate of people who don't look or talk or act like you or us. Think racism or sexism. Think even still hate for people who are like us, but are what we perceive to be a better version of what we like about ourselves. Think jealousy or envy. Think even that to the extent of murder, like Cain and Abel. And then even think hate for ourselves because we don't measure up to the version of ourselves that we claim or want to be. Think low self-esteem or a defeatist mentality, or even at the worst, self-harm or suicide. This is the result of insecurity that comes from trying to be our own gods and image ourselves or anything other than our Creator. There is an epidemic of identity crisis because we have removed God from the throne in our hearts, and we can't handle the weight of it. We can't handle being God, just like the devil tempted us, saying that we could be. Now, I'm sure you probably also recognize some good things in the world, right? Some God-like things in the world, like advocating or helping someone less fortunate, or serving or sacrificing for someone. There are even people who have laid down their lives. Things like loving or creating beautiful things or cultivating things of this world. Why is that? That's because we're still made in God's image. God has still given us these attributes. When man and woman sinned against God, they didn't just lose their communicable attributes. They just now utilize them in fallen ways for fallen ends, like self-righteousness or self-worship instead of God worship. Instead of taking their creativity to point to the glory of God, they took their creativity and used it for themselves. So we can have elements of the image of God without displaying the image of God because we still have those elements. Apart from Christ, at best, we at best use our God-like imaging ability to glorify ourselves or something that God created rather than him. And so often, Christians even get excited about imaging the things of the world rather than imaging God. So this is the problem. This is the context where Colossians comes in. This identity crisis of inability to bear God's image perfectly. That is the problem. That is the context. Enter Jesus. This section of Colossians is a series of truth statements about Jesus that change everything for us. Who Jesus is and what he has done, and that changes everything for us. Starting in verse 15, he is the image of the invisible God. Did you catch that? He is the image. So we are made to be images. We are images. He is the image, not an image. He is the image, the perfect image of God, of the invisible God. And so we see even in that phrase, he is the image of the invisible God. Well, so are you saying that as image bearers, we are made to look physically like him? Maybe like the analogy of the bananas, that we look physically like him, like humans look like humans, right? And so are we made in God's image that way? No, he's invisible God. What does that mean then? How can we be image bearers? I don't know, actually. That's a rhetorical question meant to be answered by the book. I think Paul gives us some ideas here, even if that question is not fully answered until Jesus comes back. Jesus is the image of the invisible God, and what we learn about him, who he is, and then later in chapters 3 and 4, we get to see a little bit more about what bearing God's image looks like. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. Now, I don't want to miss this bit here, because this is probably the biggest crux of the hardest thing to own and swallow and submit to as a follower of Christ. Most of us are fine with Jesus being Lord of the universe, but not the Lord of our life. Most of us are fine with Jesus being Lord of the universe, but not so much the Lord of our own life. Many Christians have tried to create this middle ground where Jesus is somehow on a throne somewhere and has won salvation for everyone, but is not Lord of everything, namely your own life and what you do and how you live. What would it look like for you to surrender that position to the true Lord? What does that poke at? What do you start to become defensive about? What is keeping you from doing that? Whatever is keeping you from doing that, that is what is currently Lord of your life. This is probably the hardest thing to deal with in this passage. Our sinful nature that we are born with, that we have to fight against, is founded on the very idea that I am Lord of my life. I'm like God in that way. I'm the boss of me. No one and nothing else has rights over me. The text completely defies our cultural narrative right now. Have you caught that in the last decade? I mean, probably more than the last decade, but certainly in the last decade. How would you define the last decade? Maybe write that down. Some overarching themes. What are some themes of our cultural narrative right now? Take a second to think about it. If you were to sum up the last decade in a thought or two, what would be some of the main themes? Jot them down. How many of these do you think have something to do with self-expression or personal rights or authority? or freedoms on the basis that I get to choose for me. We exalt these things because they seem good, but they only work based on the idea that our own lordship is true and sustainable, but it's not. And that's why there's brokenness in the world. There's a world of 7-something billion people. Did you know that? There's 7-something billion people in the world who all believe they are God, and we expect that to work somehow. If what we functionally believe was actually true and we can be like God and overthrow his kingdom, we would have long since done away with everything that holds our existence and each other together, and we have tried. If we could, we would have. But he's still God. He's still on the throne as Lord. He's still preeminent, and he still holds everything together. Did you catch that? In verse 17, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Thanks be to God that although we may have removed him from the throne in our own hearts, he can't be removed. He still loves us, and he still holds things together. Take a minute to thank and praise God for holding everything together. How happy are you that he holds your life and everything in it together? How does knowing that completely change and transform your thinking and believing right now? God holds everything together. Otherwise, it would blow up. Like you can see that even in how the earth, I'm not a science guy. I didn't do well in science. Find your local scientists and ask them about the moon and the sun and gravity and what would happen if God stopped holding everything together. And then praise God that somehow, even in those little ways, much less your life and everything you do in your heart and your mind that is falling apart, God holds everything together, and thank God for that. That's part of his restoration and rescue plan for you. And what joy does that inspire in your heart? What change might come about in your life if you really believed that all the time? And I invite you to, with me, to pray for that, to embody that truth. Moving on to verse 19, Jesus is the perfect temple. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. This could be a sermon in and of itself, so I'm just going to spend half a second on it. God has called us his temple where he is to dwell. Jesus does that perfectly. 1 Corinthians 3 says, do you not know that you are God's temple and that God's Spirit dwells in you? If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him. For God's temple is holy, and you are the temple. So in Jesus, put a pin in this, it's going to come back in a minute. In Jesus, God was pleased to dwell. Jesus was the perfect temple for God to dwell in. But what does that have to do with us? That's great for Jesus, right? He came and showed everybody up. That's great for Jesus. What does that have to do with us? Jesus did all of these amazing things that we could not do. What does that have to do with us? Verse 20. This is the pivotal verse here, and then it changes direction in verse 21 through 23. Verse 20 says, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on the earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. So these things from verse 15 through 19 are true about Jesus, and this is significant for us because through him he reconciled to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of the cross. Don't miss that here. This is the beginning of our salvation. This is the beginning, the foundation of our faith. Jesus credited us with his perfect image bearing, and restored our ability to image God rightly. Think of the first part of that phrase is what we're talking about. The second part we're about to talk about. I'm getting ahead of myself. But Jesus credited us with his perfect image bearing. Through these things, Jesus is the perfect temple. Jesus is the perfect image of God made visible. And Jesus credits us with his righteousness, making peace by the blood of his cross. And you, that sounds so accusatory, right? That's like when you hear that, you're like, yeah, what did I do? It says, and you, in verse 21, this is a good thing you want to be accused of, who were once alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds, he has now reconciled in his body of flesh by his death. So by his death, making peace by the blood of the cross, he's reconciled you specifically. First, he just says in heaven and on earth. Now he's saying you specifically. He has reconciled by his death in order to what? Present you holy and blameless and above reproach before him. Don't miss that. Catch that. What is he doing? He's not just paying your way to do whatever he wants to do. Jesus is restoring your ability to image God rightly. He has restored you to your created purpose and identity. So the thing that was missing before, which is that you would put yourself on the throne in God's place instead of God, and you had an identity crisis because you can't sustain that imaging a God when you are not one. Jesus has restored that. So in putting God on the throne like he did perfectly, he has restored you to your restored your ability to image God perfectly. And this is where the gospel story, I hope, is overused and overexplained again and again and again. There was no way for us. Our end was to be righteously obliterated by God because we were not fit to be in God's presence. That's what was true about us. God gave us one job to do, that was to image him rightly. We thought that we didn't need him, so we decided that we were going to be like God, and we couldn't handle that. And so as a result, we were cast out, not able to be in God's presence. And in that place, we also came up with all sorts of identity crises because our created purpose and identity was no longer there. But Jesus reconciled that by making peace by the blood of the cross, and he is reconciled in his body of flesh by his death. And so what we do, hold desperately to the person and work of Jesus. He is your only hope for salvation and restoration. It's not what you can do, because you can't, and you've tried. It's not what you can do. It's also not how well you can believe, because we're still unable. That's also a thing we are not able to do perfectly. It's in who you believe. It's in Jesus that you believe. That's what restores you. That's what saves you. The statement of faith, don't miss that from Colossians, the statement of faith that we cling to begins with what? He. Our statement of faith doesn't begin with I did this. How often has that been our defense in life? Our statement of faith begins with he is the image of the invisible God. And so, what is our response? This is how we can respond, and it's really simple. Following the order of indicatives and imperatives, following the order of Colossians 1 and 2 to 3 and 4. First, thing that we can take from Colossians chapter 1 is to put God on the throne as if he's not, but I mean in your own life, in your own heart, is to recognize him, declare him as Lord in your own life rather than yourself. Recognize first that it's your tendency to do that yourself, to think of you, to fall back into the temptation from Genesis chapter 3 to think that you can be like God in that way, self-sustaining when you cannot. Declare Jesus as Lord of your life. And then put to death sin and put on righteousness, just like that. Chapters 3 and 4 are the imperatives, the things you are to do. So I'm just going to read, I'm going to skim pieces of this, not to work through it, but to point you to what's next. Because of this, then this, and this is, he even says it, in starting in chapter 3, he says, if then you have been raised with Christ. That's a huge qualifier. If you try to start in chapter 3 or 4, you will be lost because this if statement is not true about you. So the first thing, Jesus has saved you. Jesus is the only way. Declare him as Lord in your life. If then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above where Christ is seated on the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are of the earth. For you have died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you will also appear with him in glory. And then he gives us a long list of ways that, practically speaking, we can become obedient to this. We can image God, put to death, therefore. And so instead of working through all of these things, where you might see them in your life, how to respond to them, that would be the next sermon, if there was a next sermon. So I invite you to do this on your own. But I want to just easily here categorize this in two different lists. And this is like verse 5 through 11 I'm looking at now, and verses 12 through 17. So, and then it goes on to more things, but certainly verse 5 through 11, put to death, therefore. What does that sound like? That doesn't sound like a to-do list. That sounds like a hit list. Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you: sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desires, and covetousness. And he goes on to list a bunch of other things: slander, obscene talk. So that's your first thing to do in response to, or sorry, the first thing is declare Jesus as Lord of your life. And then the second thing, put in two categories: first, put to death, and then put on. Verse 12, put on then as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience. And he goes on. So our response to this is declare Jesus as Lord of your life, because he is the only way. Your faith statement of belief begins with he, not I. And then the second thing is put to death and put on. And with that, I would like to lead us in prayer to commit these things to our hearts, and then we'll respond in song. Oh God, we see in your word, Lord, the difference between a pile of dust and us as people is your breath. And so we see in your word that you have breathed it out, and so it is powerful and it is good for us, Lord. And so now we respond by humble confession of who you are and what you have done, Lord. You are the perfect image, Lord. You are the perfect temple. You did it perfectly, and somehow, because you decided to, you ordained this to happen, Lord, because you loved us somehow, Lord, you, even though you knew no sin, took on sin so that we might become righteous before God, Lord. You have credited us with your righteousness. You have restored our ability to bear your image rightly. And you've also credited us with a perfect image-bearing Son so that we are seen as having the righteousness of Jesus. Lord, this is something we can't fully understand, and it's not something we can fully explain, but it is something that leads us to declare you as Lord. Lord, it leads us to declare thanksgiving, Lord. Lord, would you now lead us to confess where we don't do this? Lord, would you now lead us to confess where we do not declare you as Lord in our life, where we still hold on to things, we still try to be God even though we can't? Lord, would you lead us to see those things, lead us to lay those things down, and lead us to declare you Lord of our life in those places? Lord, would you also lead us in a lifelong putting to death of sin and things that are contrary to you? Lord, we know that we will fail in our ability and response, Lord. History has taught us this, Lord. Everything in your word says that we are not enough, but Lord, you are enough. You are good enough. Lord, but would you lead us now in a lifelong putting to death of sin and a lifelong of putting on righteousness, Jesus-likeness, so that we might bear your image. Lord, these are the things that might even have eternal significance. These are the things that we desire now to be excited about, to participate in. Lord, it's because of your cross and the blood that you shed for us that we can even declare and rejoice in these things. And it's in your name that we pray and believe. Amen.